I'll call the meeting to order. Thank you for coming today. We don't have a quorum as of yet, but I want to begin because we have an ambitious agenda, and I want to be able to give everyone, especially those that traveled, enough time to make their presentations. So we will begin with Mr. Craig Pagel from the Iron Mining Association, and this segment will be 10 minutes in length and approximately 5 minutes for questions from the committee. Mr. Pagel, welcome.
Thank you, Chair Anzalz. My name is Craig Pagel. I'm the president of the Iron Mining Association. What I'm going to do today is give you just kind of a broad overview of the iron mining industry in Minnesota. We're going to have individual companies come down and give you a little more specific information. But what I'm hoping to do is give you a little bit of an idea of what iron mining is like in northern Minnesota and how it affects the whole state of Minnesota. And one of the themes we have is Imagine Life Without Iron. And I don't think the sound is working on this for us. No. Where's our... There we go. I'm not there yet. We might have to go back. Nope. Okay. That's not coming up here either. Go ahead. I can see. Nope. Okay. Let's go ahead and we can move on. That's not a problem. Yeah, we'll just move on. Anyway, that was supposed to be a little bit of an idea of how iron is used in our everyday lives, whether it's appliances, medical, farming. We all use iron in our everyday life. We have been celebrating 130 years of iron mining this last year. Governor was kind enough to declare iron mining in the United States. And what's interesting, that first mine is now a state park, the Sudan Mine. Minnesota's iron mining today and the future, I want to give you a little bit of information about that. And as the IMA, Iron Mining Association, our job is to promote the iron ore industry, so I'll have to admit that right off the beginning. The different mines that are presently operating in Minnesota are made up from ArcelorMittal's Minorca mine with 2.7 million tons production capacity. Cliffs Natural Resources owns and operates or operates United Taconite at 5.2, Hibbing Taconite, and North Shore. They make up almost half of the iron ore produced. Magnetation is new in the iron mining industry. They're going to give you a little more information about them, but they're a brand new technology. They have approximately 3.5 million tons that they produce. Steel Dynamics, another new type of technology with Masabi Nugget. You're going to hear a little bit more about them. Instead of 60% iron, they have an iron nugget that's about 97%. And I believe in your packs, you have the four different types where it starts with the rock, goes to a concentrate, some is pellet, and others are nuggets. And if you still have your magnets, you'll be able to see where they're the magnetic. And there's going to be some of them that aren't. And I bet someone can explain why when something's heated like iron, it changes its magnetism. Steel Dynamics also has mining resources. U.S. Steel, Keetac, and Minntac make up about half the iron production in Minnesota. And in the last 7 years, we've gone from 40 million tons to about 46, 47 million tons. And being constructed at this time is Esser Steel. And they will, once completed, have a capacity of 7 million tons. Now, we think of the Iron Range. You hear that it's 120 miles long. It's a pretty proud heritage up there. And yet, we think how big that area is. But if you take all of the mine pits, they're still only half the size of Minneapolis. You could fit all the mine pits into Minneapolis and still have room for twice as many. And yet we have reclamation requirements, so all our land will be reclaimed, and so it's usable, whether it's going to be anything from lakes back into lakes, or there might even be hills, ski places, bike trails, etc. It's a highly technical industry, and the skilled professionals we have changed completely, and we've been working on education projects. And the mining industry is really changing around the globe, but we are actually at the forefront with some of our new technologies, whether it's the nuggets, even the taconite facilities that are there, or magnetation. Last 4 years, the mines have spent more than $78 million to upgrades in existing facilities. That, I believe, is just with some of the upgrades. It doesn't include the new facilities. Excuse me. Minnesota iron ore supply 80% of the first core steel in the United States. That's important to note, as the state often looks at having our energy be supplied just from the United States. Why shouldn't we have our minerals supplied from it? And also think of the national security that implies with 80% of the first core steel. And a lot of people say, well, why don't you just recycle more? Iron and steel are the highest recycled material in the United States at over 90%. Expansions and new projects. I'm going to talk a little bit first about what is happening right now. Current operations generate over $3 billion annually. And this is a report from the University of Minnesota Skrula report that was conducted several years ago. New projects could generate an additional $4.3 billion in economic impact. The existing mines right now, before the new construction, actually make up 30% of the gross regional product of northeastern Minnesota, northwestern Wisconsin. The additional $4.3 billion would bring in 14,200 new jobs. That doesn't include the construction. Not only construction of jobs, but the dollar amounts. New construction alone would be $3.5 billion, somewhere between 2012 and 2016. Some of the projects have moved ahead, others have been delayed a little bit, but I think those numbers are probably still representative. Existing operations and new projects combined annually will account for $7.3 billion and 25,000 jobs. Taxes and royalties. We heard a little bit from the DNR a couple of weeks ago when they were in the committee. Our production tax for 2014 were $101 million. Occupation tax was 15.8, and that's similar to a business tax that other businesses pay. Royalties paid just to the state in either K-12 or the University Trust Fund were $71.3 million, for a total of $188 million just in 2014. Where does the distribution go? Production tax is in lieu of property tax. And so it stays pretty much in the taconite relief area. School districts would receive about $21 million, IRRRB $32 million, counties $14.5 million, cities and townships $14.9 million, and property tax relief. The people that live in the taconite relief area actually get their property taxes reduced some from this production tax and other taxes of 12.8 distributed in other counties and other areas. Royalties and occupation tax distribution. The school trust fund, K-12, you heard the DNR say that they supplied $50 million to school trust a couple weeks ago. Another $8 million comes from the occupation tax. The U of M trust received about $16.8 million. That's what makes up the corpus of the university trust fund, which is at about $900 million now, if I'm not mistaken. Counties received $3.7 million. General fund, almost $8 million. Just this last year, we've worked with the University of Minnesota. They go out and do surveys and through their different department, economics. And what one of the questions we asked is, are you aware that we have mining, iron mining in Minnesota? 89% of the Minnesotans were aware of the current iron mining. 96% of Minnesotans think Minnesota should continue mining iron. But what's kind of interesting is when we ask the question, do you know how you use iron every day? 50% knew how, 50% didn't know how they used iron. And looking at the demographics, it's kind of interesting. Lower income, lower aged do not know how they use iron every day. But when you get over $150,000 a year, those people don't know how they use iron every day. So it's kind of interesting demographics. So we have some work ahead of us to help people understand how we use our natural resources every day, whether it's agricultural, mining, some of the other things like forestry. So we have some stuff ahead of us. Now, unfortunately, I had some more ads to show you that we've been running to get people to kind of think about it, but our sound isn't working, but maybe the visual will work out pretty good. And I don't think my computer might be able to pick it up if it's on here. not. As you know, we've got a lot of different demographics in the state, so we have to reach a lot of different people. And this is my favorite one coming up. So I'd like you to imagine what life would be like without iron, and I stand for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Pagel.
Thank you.
Members, are there any questions for Mr. Pagel and the Iron Mining Association? Representative Lewick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Back to those actually taxes, not necessarily royalties, but do you have any estimate on the level of personal income tax that those 25,000 jobs generate for our economy in Minnesota, sir?
I do not have those figures. We could work with the Department of Revenue and try and get those figures for you.
Thank you, Monsieur. That would be an area we probably really look at, and would also ask if there's a way to look at the spin-off on the general sales tax that's generated by that huge amount of income that's obviously spent in that area. It would that's another whole element that we certainly should be aware of and appreciate.
I appreciate the question, Chair and Representative. I don't have that information, but we can work with the Department of Revenue, see if there's a way that they can pull some of the information together.
Okay. Any other questions? Representative Metza.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. God, I'm having a potential hard time. We got a DFL chair now. It's pretty fun.
You never know.
No, I just, Representative Lewick wanted to point out, on average, it's about two spin-off jobs for every one iron mining job.
Representative Dill.
The other thing I wanted to point out is a few years ago we canceled the royalty tax before I got in the legislature, the tax on royalties. But they're the royalties that are paid for by the fee holders, and I don't remember, you had it on the screen what the fee holders are paying. Do you remember that number?
Chair Representative Dill, the number I had, that's just the royalties that are state-owned.
Oh, state-owned.
It does not have the fee holders.
So we've got huge fee holders in our state that own mineral rights, kind of like yesterday's hearing where the people had the house and they didn't own the minerals, so they own the minerals. And that is subject to Minnesota income taxes, or in money that is earned in Minnesota by the fee holders. So not only do we get the we also get, I want to make it clear, income tax, just like if you were a football player and earn money in football, when they extract the out of the ground, they pay Minnesota income taxes on those royalties. The owner of the ore that was used, they pay, just like a football player would pay in Minnesota when he plays the Minnesota Vikings.
Okay. Any other questions?
Thank you,
Mr. Pagel, and thank you for organizing the other mining companies, the members of your association, so that they could be here today so we could have this hearing. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Chair.
Okay.
I'll be around if you have other questions.
Thank you. Members, we have a quorum, and I saw Representative Hertas diligently reading the minutes, so would you care to move the minutes?
So moved.
Minutes stand approved, and we'll move on. On our agenda, next up is Cliffs Natural Resources. Members, Cliffs Natural Resources is involved in three mining operations on the Mesabi North Shore in the Silver Bay Babbitt area, Eveleth Taconite, and Hibbing Taconite. And with us is Terry Fetter, Executive Vice President, United States Iron Ore Operations with Cliffs Natural Resources, and would you please identify yourself?
Anya Ediger, Government Affairs for Cliffs Natural Resources.
Okay. And Mr. Fetter, would you please identify yourself for the record as well?
Yeah, Terry Fedor, Executive Vice President of U.S. Iron Ore Operations, Cliffs Natural Resources.
Proceed, and you have 15 minutes.
Okay. Well, good afternoon, Chairman Anzels and Vice Chairman Lewick and Ranking Member Dill and members of the committee. Thank you for your interest in Minnesota's taconite industry and for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Terry Fedor, and I serve as Cliffs Natural Resources Executive Vice President of U.S. Iron Ore Operations, and I'm responsible for the company's U.S. Iron Ore Operations, as well as transportation and logistics functions, supply chain, and asset management. I have over 25 years of experience in the iron ore and steel industries, and I would like to take this opportunity today to highlight Cliffs' historical and continuing commitment to Minnesota, describe current market conditions, and share some perspective on state policy issues confronting the taconite industry. By the way of background, Cliffs Natural Resources is a merchant miner and the largest producer of iron ore pellets in North America. We mine low-grade iron ore and process it into value-added iron ore pellets. These pellets are used to make iron in the integrated blast furnace and ultimately become the high-quality steel used to manufacture automobiles, appliances, and countless other products that we use every day. Here in Minnesota, Cliffs wholly owns and operates United Taconite and North Shore Mining Company. In addition, Cliffs co-owns Hibbing Taconite with our partners ArcelorMittal and U.S. Steel and manages that facility on behalf of that partnership. Together, these three facilities can produce up to 19.5 million tons of pellets annually, and they employ over 1,800 individuals with a total economic impact of nearly $900 million annually. As I mentioned in my introduction, Cliffs has a long history in Minnesota and a proven track record of creating and preserving jobs and economic opportunity on the Iron Range. For example, this past fall, Cliffs held a large employee and community event in Eveleth to celebrate the 10-year anniversary of bringing the former Eveleth Taconite out of bankruptcy, quite the success story. In 2003, Cliffs partnered with Leiwu Steel Company of China to acquire EVTAC and resume operations as United Taconite. Over 10 years later, Cliffs has maintained continuous operation of United Taconite and is now 100% owner with a workforce of over 500 individuals. Earlier on, during another difficult period in this cyclical business, Cliffs acquired North Shore Mining Company in Babbitt and Silver Bay, where we maintain a payroll of over $80 million. Furthermore, Cliffs has been the managing partner of Hibbing Taconite since the mid-1980s. With this proud history, today Cliffs is executing on an aggressive strategy of refocusing our core U.S. iron ore operations in Minnesota and New Michigan, while moving away from the more volatile global trade for steelmaking commodities. While more stable than the global iron ore trade, the U.S. iron ore business faces significant challenges associated with the recent plunge in iron ore prices and customers in the integrated steel business that face record imports of dumped and unfairly traded steel products. Fortunately, taconite pellet supply and North American pellet demand are generally in balance, which helps keep Minnesota's operations viable. The addition of any new, unneeded iron ore capacity, however, would have a disruptive and adverse impact on existing jobs and production here in Minnesota. As we have for 168 years, Cliffs will weather the down cycle. We continue to plan for the long-term viability of our operations by maintaining the important relationships we have with our customers, as well as exploring opportunities to access new markets, including pellets especially designed for the production of direct reduced iron. We are committed to working with our public officials, community leaders, and all our stakeholders to maintain and enhance the viability of Minnesota's taconite sector. To that end, I would like to very briefly address two policy issues of particular importance to Cliffs and to the entire taconite industry: Minnesota's sulfate wild rice standard and energy policy. Cliffs embraces environmental stewardship as one of our core values, and we strive to be good stewards of the air, water, and natural resources that make northern Minnesota a great place to call home. In order to ensure that our efforts and dollars are spent in a way that best protects and preserves the environment, It is critical that environmental regulations be firmly rooted in sound science. The state of Minnesota continues to grapple with an outdated sulfate wild rice standard that has no basis in sound science. We support the state's ongoing efforts to analyze new research on sulfate in order to revise the standard to be reflective of new scientific findings. In the meantime, the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency must ensure public and regulated entities are afforded the opportunity to participate in the establishment of this standard through a formal, transparent rulemaking process. Treating sulfate to the existing arbitrary limit is estimated to cost mines, municipalities, and other businesses in the state hundreds of millions of dollars. For our industry in particular, this could mark a fundamental shift in our cost structure and negatively affect our ability to produce taconite pellets competitively. Thus, we ask for the legislature's involvement to ensure that the MPCA adheres to the procedures in the Clean Water Act in establishing this water quality limit. With regard to energy, taconite mining and processing is energy intensive, with energy accounting for nearly one-third of our costs. In 2014, combined electric power costs for our three operations in Minnesota totaled over $145 million. Historically, industrial electric rates in Minnesota have been some of the lowest in the Midwest. However, they have been steadily increasing and at the current trajectory could become some of the highest in the region. It is forecasted that electric rates for our mines will increase by 17 to 20% over the next 5 years. While we go to extreme lengths to save energy and ensure efficiency, the mines have no ability to pass these costs on to our customers. Thus, we urge state policymakers to advocate for an energy policy that structures energy rates in a fair and equitable manner in order to maintain the competitiveness of industries that provide family-sustaining jobs across the state. In closing, I am grateful for the opportunity to speak to the committee today. And going forward, Cliffs will continue to work with our communities, workforce, elected officials, and all stakeholders to ensure that our taconite operations continue to add value to the region. On behalf of Cliffs, I reiterate our commitment to the state of Minnesota, and I thank you for your time today. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Fitter. Members, questions for Cliffs? Comments? Representative McNamara, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Sir, and I apologize, I missed your name.
Terry Fedor.
Fedor.
Longy.
Fedor.
Yeah.
Fedor.
Mr. Fedor, what would you suggest in the sulfate standards, the wild rice standard? Do you have some suggestions for MPCA specifically?
Well, I suggest is we work together with the state and we base our decisions on sound science, and we put a lot of our expertise in the room, as well as other stakeholders within the business community. We work together to solve that problem.
Just a quick follow-up. Do you think it's right that we're the only state that would have that standard in the nation? Do you think that's fair or correct?
I think we have to look at the science. We have to let the science tell us the story. We need to take a look at work together, like I suggested, that we work together. We suggest as Cliffs, we work together to try to base any decisions that we do make, on sound science.
Thank you.
Representative Dill.
Thank you, Chairman Anzell. Let me ask you, we heard in this committee recently that there is, it is my understanding that wild rice receiving waters are the ones that would get the standard applied to it of 10 milligrams per liter. However, when we asked the MPCA if they had a list of wild rice receiving waters, they said no, there is no list that exists. But yet I understand that there are permits that have been issued to Ferrous mining companies that have the standard in it. So I don't understand how, in the absence of a list of identified wild rice receiving waters, that they can apply, put a permit in permits of mining companies, and then I have heard that there are emitters through local units of government or different various quasi-governmental agencies that handle wastewater, as an example, that are discharging into wild rice receiving waters that are in excess of the 10 milligrams, some of them many times in excess, but they do not have the same things in their permits. I'm wondering what your comment is on that, or comment from the industry on that. That seems to me to be like shadow boxing from an industry, and I'm thinking that it would inhibit a board of directors of a company like Cliffs to say, we want to spend $25 million there to update our plan, or $100 million in the case of iron mining, to update a plant. How do you shadow box with the regulations and get your board to authorize capital expenditures in our state?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dill, yes, it's difficult. what we need to do is regroup around this issue, and our position is that we need to, as an industry, and as a and as there's other stakeholders that you identify, it's not just iron mining. We need to regroup around it, reexamine the science, understand it, and relook at the way we want to apply any permitting in the future.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Dill.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think you're being too nice.
I agree. Representative Yaruso.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When you say you should work together with them, what do you mean? Are you envisioning conducting laboratory studies yourself, or what exactly does that
mean? Well, I think all about working together to design the experiment, design the way that we go about agreeing on the data. You know, we need to base things on facts and data, and I think that what's lacked is we haven't been able to apply sound science, and then we started to try to apply standards, or as Representative Dill said, you know, started to apply permitting to it. And what we need to do is regroup around this issue, put the smart people in the room, and let's figure out where the science takes us.
Mr. Chair, so what would the role of the company be in that? Because you say we need to work together. I agree, you know, about the sound science part. I don't necessarily agree that I want a commercial entity designing the experiments for the DNR. So what do you mean when you say work together?
Literally bring the scientists together, study, agree to a process to study it, agree to a scoping study, agree to an understanding, and working through the whole understanding of what the problem is, where the science, let the science lead us where it goes.
Representative Yaruso.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Now, I'm not weighing in on the validity of what's gone before or what the standard is now or anything like that, but I would find it kind of unusual that the entities to be permitted would be the ones that would tell the scientists at the DNR how to conduct their business. I would love it to be as open as possible a process, but to have industry telling the permitting authorities how to conduct their science is a little bit backwards to me. So I'd be interested to see exactly what the form that would take. Do you have experience within the company of people running biological experiments?
I oversee people who do, but what I would propose is...
Excuse me, Mr. Chair. Was that a yes or a no?
Huh?
Was that a yes or a no?
I do not personally conduct biological experiments. But what I would like to say is that we'd be more than happy to take this offline with you at a later date and get you comfortable with what our folks do know, and we can address the issue, you know, at a later date in a private or public forum, whatever we want to do.
Mr. Feeder, perhaps your colleague would like to take a shot at that.
Sure. I would like to say that we'd be happy to speak with you at a later time in detail about this issue. And I think in terms of, you asked about the role of the public, our position would be that any enforcement of a standard should be, or the designation of water should be conducted through a formal rulemaking process, which allows the public to participate in this issue.
Representative Yarusso, let's wrap it up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We agree on the role of the public. What I asked was, does the company have scientists that are qualified and are accustomed to doing biological testing? That was the yes or no question.
To the testifiers.
And that'll be it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
I'd be happy to speak with you about that at a later time.
Okay.
Hear a yes or no to my end.
Thank you, Representative Yarusso. Representative Malian.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to maybe provide some clarity. I don't know if it will or not, but I don't think that they're saying they should present science and that science should be accepted. I think what they're saying is that everybody deserves a seat at the table, and the way to get people to have a seat at the table is if MPCA would enter a rulemaking process specifically for designated waters, to Representative Dill's earlier point, which we've discussed in this committee before. You know, I think we heard the MPCA testify that basically they sit down in a room together, they discuss should this be a wild rice water, they then go to the tribes to see what their opinion is on whether or not it should be a wild rice water, and they then designate it as a wild rice water or not. I don't necessarily think that that process is fair. I think that there should be a rulemaking process so that everybody gets to comment on what is a wild rice water. You know, historically in this state, there's been wild rice growing, you know, near Fort Snelling and areas where it certainly isn't growing now. And, you know, my point is that there needs to be a broader discussion on what is a wild rice water. And I think what Cliffs is trying to say is, you know, they would like a seat at the table when it comes to that discussion. Nobody is suggesting that one entity or industry propose a standard or present science and that be accepted. But I think that having an open rulemaking process is certainly in the best interest of the process.
Thank you, Representative Malian. Representative Lewick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just make this comment relative to government agencies doing all the heavy lifting on the scientific experiments. If we look to some of the things that have been done in the federal government, without proper peer review, we found that we ended up in a real bad place with unsound science. So I'd be very cautious about naming either MPCA or the DNR as the so-called experts in the room. At best, anything they do would need absolute, stringent peer review by the folks that we pay to research. I think we pay the DNR to primarily manage as opposed to do high-level research. So I just like to make that point I think we're possibly being just a little bit unfair to the testifier here in this line of questioning.
Thank you. Representative Cornish.
Oh, real quickly, Mr. Chair, I was going to say the same thing as Lewick, your Representative Lewick. I think agribusiness alone and industry has been suffering for years at the hands of the DNR and MPCA in certain aspects of best practices, what they consider and their best science. And I think private companies now are sending spaceships to the moon, and I think we can prove we can do just as good as NASA. I'm sure private companies can come up with good science and best practices right along with the DNR and MPCA.
Thank you. Representative Dill?
I was thinking of something as I was thinking this whole thing through, is that, you know, when my dad and I agreed on something when I was young, it was never a problem. But when we disagreed, it was always a problem, right? Well, the MPCA is my dad and the mining companies are me. And there's no standard. There can be a standard, but there's no list. So how could you put in the Keewatin Taconite permit that it's 10 when we don't even know if that's a wild rice receiving water? because there's no list. There's something wrong with that. And, I mean, if we fix that, you won't hear me talk about it anymore. Something wrong with it.
Thank you, Representative Dill, and thank you for the testifiers. And I would just simply add, everybody at this table is cognizant of the issue, and we're looking for a solution, and we think a public process with the science driving the process will serve the best interests of everyone. So that's our goal. So thank you for coming.
Yeah, thank you very much, yep. Chairman.
Next, we have Magnetation, one of the newest, largest, recent employers in the mining industry on the Mesabi. With us is Mr. Mike Twite, the environmental manager for Magnetation, and our old friend, former Representative Lauren Solberg, who now represents this company here and in Minnesota. So it's all yours.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. But I don't know about that word old. How about just
I knew it.
thank you very much for being here. I'm Lauren Solberg, representing Magnetation. And let me call, in your packet, you should have something that looks like this. And instead of having a PowerPoint, we have some pictures out from us. A little bit of history on the iron ore formation in northern Minnesota. As you go from the west to the east or east to the west, the iron mining formation changes. Iron is an unsteady commodity or unsteady atom. That's why it rusts. And oxygen combines with it, whether it be with FeO2 or FeO or Fe2O3, etc. It's a different composition of iron and oxygen. And that composition means it's magnetic or not as strong magnetic. On the eastern end of the iron range, it's called magnetite. And it's a hard, strong rock. It's very highly magnetic. And that's where we have the taconite plants. As you go to the western end of the range, it's called hematite. It's a redder ore, it's a softer ore, and at one time they dug it up, cleaned it up by washing it to get some of the sand out, shipped it off, and put it in the blast furnace. Well, as they washed it, and this was developed in the early 1900s, the developer was John C. Greenway. You've probably heard of Greenway High School of Coleraine, named after him. As it was washed, obviously, there was fines that went out into the tailing basins. It wasn't all just pure sand that went out there. And as they also mined the iron ore in the areas, some of that was not washable, so they piled it up. We called them dumps. There were dumps that were overburdened dumps, and there were red ore dumps, and they're still there. With new technology that has been developed by Magnetation, they're able to go back in and reclaim these old, what we call either tailing basins or dumps, and doing mining, reclaiming some of the waste products that existed in the area. And I would like to turn that over then to Mr. Twite to explain that process. It's new technology. It's exciting technology.
Thank you, Mr. Solber. Chair Anzo, committee members, good afternoon. My name is Michael Twite. I'm the environmental manager for Magnetation. As Mr. Solberg said, we are simply a company that recycles these legacy mining sites to recover iron that was left behind from the first generation, the initial generation of mining before the taconite industry came into being. It's a young company. This company was founded approximately 8 years ago. The first 2 years, from 2006 to 2008, really was research and development with the original founders. 2008 was really the year of commercialization. We went from a pilot plant and an idea and lab work to really the first manufacturing facility, 2008-2009, a one-year time period to prove that the technology worked at a commercial level. Then there was 5 years of build and grow. We're just finishing that part up. Now we're at about a 3 to 3.5 million ton a year iron ore company manufacturing business. We have, as you can see in the attachment, there's a facility shown down on the bottom. What we refer to as Plant 1 was that commercial-scale pilot plant that was built. The plant in Beauvais was in 2012. That started up. Our sister plant, we are partners with Steel Dynamics in another facility over by Chisholm, and that's Mining Resources, and we are a minority position in that operation. And then the one we just started up here right on New Year's Eve was Plant 4 on the north side of the Canisteo mine pit over in the Coleraine area. So it's been a rapid growth for this company. In 2009, we had approximately 30 employees. 2012, I think I was number 100, and now we're at 475. There was a question that was asked earlier about direct payroll. Our direct payroll right now is about $33.5 million a year. You add in benefits, and we're $47, $48 million a year. Average loaded wage package for our employees is $100,000 a year. So that's kind of the history of the company, where we are as of February 2015. The process is relatively simple. It's very technically detailed, but when you boil it down, that's really the middle sections of photographs on the handout. The material on the left is the feedstock. This is a tailings basin material that looks like red beach sand, for lack of a better explanation. The excavation process is the same way you would dig a foundation for a house, right? Not when you're in a tailings basin. It's backhoes and trucks. We go through our proprietary separation process, and where we are recovering that iron ore concentrate from the feed. That's the top right picture. That's 65% iron. It's 95% hematite, which is the iron oxide. And that is, of course, the main ingredient. For us, it's hematite. For others, it's magnetite, the main ingredient to make an iron ore pellet, which is the picture down below, which is, again, the feedstock for a blast furnace. So, again, it's a simple excavation. In the separation process, everything is done in a slurry, and it's really a combination of grinding material to the right size and doing some magnetic separation and a few other proprietary things. You dewater the final product, and then it gets transported to a rail loadout facility near Grand Rapids, and then it goes off to one of two places via rail, either to Mexico, to one of our customers, or to a pellet plant that we built down in Indiana. So all of that product is being used to make North American steel. What we have learned in this, a new business line that we're just starting, is really we've developed a great expertise in process automation. So we're looking at it as a possible spin-off business line. There's more electrical engineers in that company than anywhere I've ever been. Everything's automated. It's the process control is quite amazing, and that's a new thing for us. So that's our process. That's our product. What's the future? 2015, our focus is to finish commissioning and startup of our Plant 4 in Coleraine, work through some startup items at the Indiana pellet plant, of course. That just started up last October. Try and settle down for a year and not build anything. The issues that we face really going forward are those, we share those same issues with all the mining companies. The water quality standard implementations that Cliffs has discussed, cost management, of course, in this market is at the top of everyone's list. Wetlands regulation, of course, is something that impacts all of our work as well, just due to the location of these tailings basins. Back when the early 1900s, when you wanted a tailings basin, you found the low ground, and that's where you put the pipe. So wetlands mitigation and wetlands reclamation is a big focus for us going forward as we are held to reclaiming tailings basins, as everyone else is, to a much higher standard than when we started operating now. So to close, I'll turn it back to Mr. Solberg.
Well, first of all, we're very, very happy that magnetation is using the new technologies. When I first went to the range in 1965, April, I was assigned a student teach there. Just north of or east of Bovee Coleraine area was a little pilot plant that the federal government was building. And when I got there, they were tearing it down before it got built. And the pilot plant was an experiment by the federal government to try to make hematite more magnetic and to be able to use it in the taconite process. Magnetation has found that technology without having to have a pilot plant. It's been a private business and the new technologies that have been able to be able to get this process going. Magnetation, and when you come in and reclaim something that has been in existence, closed down for 20, 30 years, as it may have been, presents some problems. But magnetation has been a very great community member. They ran into some problems with in their mine area. There was an Itasca County gun club. Well, they can't have a gun club in a mining area, so they helped move and are working with the gun club to find a new location and preserve the gun club. The Mesabi bike track trail went through their mining property now, or permit to mine property. It's kind of tough to have bikes going through where you might be mining. They paid for and relocated the bike trail. And the municipalities in the IRRRB on Highway 169, as they were hauling and increased the truck traffic, they went to the Department of Transportation and said, we need a turnoff lane, would be kind of nice for safety orders. And the department says, well, go ahead and you can build it if you want. We don't have the money. And they did, to make sure that their truck traffic was safe on the highway. So they've proved to be a very, very good company for the community and are working with community leaders to solve any problems that may exist. We invite you to come up for a tour and stand for any questions. We look forward to have you come up sometime, even in the wintertime. It's okay.
Thank you very much. Representative Hertas has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You mentioned the mining operation and the reclamation of the old tailings. I was just curious, how much of that are you reclaiming and what percent of a ton of material is going back into tailings again?
Mr. Chair, Representative, it gets looked at in a couple of ways. It's really measured in two different ways. One, just on a weight basis. If I take a ton of tailings material out of the tailings basin, how many tons, you know, how much goes back, is largely driven by the iron concentration in that basin itself. If I had to say it, as an average, it's about a 25% weight recovery. So 75% of the material goes back into the basin it came from.
Okay.
Yeah. That's pretty good recovery of iron units that are there, 25%.
Yeah, I'm sure that diamond and gold miners would like that type of recovery.
Well, the iron recovery is a different beast, but that's a pretty reasonable average for what we've seen thus far.
Okay, Representative McNamara.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Solberg, welcome back. And
not rep anymore.
Well, you're still a representative. You never lose that title. So
it's good to be back, yeah, Mr. Chair and well, Representative.
Thank you. You're worth it with a great company, and I just want to say my hat's off to Magnetation and what you're doing. You really glossed over, one, you didn't even mention the one picture on here. You've got six slides, and the one you mentioned was the good-looking picture, and I think it's important for folks to know. You just mentioned, Mr. Twight, real quickly, that you restore it to better than you found it, and I think that's important for people to know that you're working under today's rules when many of these basins were established generations or sometimes almost a century ago, and you're doing a really good thing environmentally. And I was amazed. I had no idea that your recovery was in the 20-25%. I'm sure it can vary on the basins, but we need to strongly encourage and work with you, because when you think about how you can go through the whole iron range and redo it and reclaim it and make it look better and get, I had no idea that there was that kind of a percentage of that material there. So I think hats off to you, to the founders, in what you're doing, and I look forward to the challenge to really moving you forward. I can imagine you want to take a deep breath, the whole company, on the pace you've been on, but we're excited about what you're doing, and not only the range delegation, but a lot of us around the state are very thankful and look forward to you making it even better up there. So thank you.
Well, thank you. And
Mr. Twight.
Thank you, Chair Anzel, Mr. McNamara. And I will say, you know, all the mining companies are held to these standards. So it's not that we are, our advantage has been that we've been going into places with a technology that wasn't feasible before. But the standards and the expectation that DNR has on all mining companies, you know, the bar is here. Whereas, and on all of these sites that we operate in, all predated any reclamation rules in the state of Minnesota. So, again, thank you.
Well, Mr. Chair and Mr. Twight, just to reiterate what Representative Dill said, the bar is up here for you. It's not up there for the wastewater treatment plant. So sorry, I couldn't help but say it. Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions? Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're a very innovative company and a very good presentation. Next, we have the company Steel Dynamics, which owns and operates what we call on the Mesabi Nugget facility. And with us is David Bednarz. Mr. Bednarz, it's all yours.
Chairman, committee, my pleasure to be here representing the Steel Dynamics organization. I've been in the mining minerals processing industry for well over 30 years. The last almost 18 years has been associated with Steel Dynamics, and all of it has been on developing new technologies with SDI. And I like to say that I had long brown hair, and it was all in my head when I started developing new technologies, and it's all since gone away. So it's been a very rewarding in some sense, but challenging time period within Steel Dynamics. Start out with a little bit of background on SDI. We're a new kid on the block, really, as far as steel companies go, a bit over 20 years old. The company was founded by three individuals, and I characterize them as having an unwavering belief in the American industry and an unwavering belief in the American worker. And the thought that if you give a group of people the right tools, you give them a piece of the action, that ultimately you end up with a business plan that's very, very difficult to beat. And certainly within SDI, that's held to be true. When I started 18 years ago, we had one operation in Northeast Indiana producing about 1 million tons a year with less than 400 people. You fast forward to where we are right now, and we're an organization approaching 8,000 people, 11 million tons of steelmaking capacity, operating in all across the United States, from Northeast Minnesota, Northeast Florida, from Nevada to North Carolina. So truly an American success story, no matter what industry you're working in, let alone the steel industry. As with any of the steel and mining companies on the Iron Range, safety is a core value for us. And I'm happy to say that of the 100-plus sites that we operate around the United States, last year, over half of them went completely incident-free. A little bit closer to home, our mining resources operation that Mike mentioned right around Chisholm, we operated well over 600 days without a recordable incident at that operation. Very, very proud of the group there and what they were able to accomplish, and something that we've got to continue to build upon. If we focus on the company as a whole just a little bit, four main components, it's centered upon the steel makers. We've got six electric arc furnace steel making facilities around the United States. And it's important to distinguish between the electric arc furnace producers and the integrated producers. The traditional taconite folks that Craig focused on earlier that make the taconite pellets cannot be used in an electric arc furnace. It's a very, very important part. And until Mesabi Nugget started, we're the only operation in the Iron Range serving that segment of the industry. And also important to note that about two-thirds of the steel that's manufactured in the United States today comes from the electric arc furnace segment of the business. So about two-thirds of our revenues are tied up in the steel-making capacity. About a third of our business comes from metals recycling part of our business. We're the second largest ferrous scrap recycler in the United States. We processed just under 6 million tons last year of ferrous scrap and over a billion pounds of non-ferrous materials. Think a billion pounds, a lot of pop cans, right, you know, when you talk about it. Last year, 6-7% of our business was wrapped up in our fabrication segment. When you go into a Menards store, a Lowe's store, you look up at the ceiling, you see the big joists up there. That's what we do in our fabrication segment of our business. And finally, we got the iron making side, which we're here to focus on today. Our iron making efforts started in Northeast Indiana. We've got the only facility of its type in Indiana producing a liquid iron product. And then we've got the facilities in northern Minnesota, which we'll talk about in a bit more detail. You ask why iron? What's unique about it? Why do you need it? And in an electric arc furnace business, some percentage of the feed material be very metallurgically clean to be able to make some of the grades of steel that we manufacture. Thus, the need for the Mesabi nugget material on the iron range. Before we started our iron making efforts, all of these virgin pig iron materials were coming from either Eastern Europe or South America. So our goal was having some control over those raw materials and bringing those jobs back to the United States. Talk a little bit about our operations in Minnesota, kind of broken up into three segments. We'll talk about Mesabi Nugget. Our original mining thought was at the Mesabi Mining there in Hoyt Lakes, and talk a little bit about our Chisholm facility that Mike mentioned just a second ago. On the Mesabi Nugget front, we're the only first and only plant doing what we're doing. There is nobody else making an iron nugget anywhere in the world. We're commercializing what's called the IT Mark III technology that was developed by Kobe Steel in Japan. We talked about this technology linking the iron range to the electric arc furnace part of the steel making industry. And I also think that it's again important to note that we're the ones that can be used directly in the EAF. We operate it's a joint venture. We're a bit over 80% owned by Steel Dynamics, operated by Steel Dynamics. Over $300 million invested in our facility and in Hoyt Lakes, about a two-year construction project. And for those of you that were on the range at the time, we started right in the depth of the Great Recession. We're the only thing going at that point in time. Large construction project. So think about what we're doing at Mesabi Nugget. We're trying to simplify the iron making process. We're combining the iron range pellet plant, the sinter plant, the coke making facility, and a blast furnace into one unit. So the overall goal was, if you can reduce the steps, hopefully you'd be able to take some of the cost out and end up with a process that's ultimately more environmentally sound as well. A little bit about our progress. Ultimately, the nameplate capacity in the facility is a bit over 500,000 tons a year. You can see the progression on the screen there of our productivity. Last year, we produced just under 250,000 tons of nuggets. So I think the best way I can put it is we've had a rough go, you know. And I think all of us anticipated developing new technology. We're gonna hit some stumbling blocks, some roadblocks. I don't think any of us anticipated that the startup to be as long and arduous as it has been, particularly since the investment that we put into the pilot plant that we had in on the north shore of Lake Superior. Focus on the typical nugget characteristic, the 97% total iron, that we produce a product that's 97%, and that's metallic iron. And you contrast that with the typical taconite pellet that, depending on the grades they're making, if it's fluxed or not fluxed, is typically 64-68% total iron, and all of their iron is in the oxide form versus the metallic form. So that's the reason that our material can be used in an electric arc furnace. On the environmental front, just a quick chart there to contrast the environmental benefit of what we're doing in our facility and the lower overall emissions of our process versus the more traditional steelmaking process. picture on the screen there is it's kind of my heart and soul, and where I lost all my hair, the development of the process here, and I could talk for hours about this particular picture, but it depicts the iron nuggets and the material being taken off the hearth of the actual furnace, and this is really the core of the technology and what's taken us the time to develop and get to where we are at this point in time. We move on to the mining operation, and you ask why do we do this in Minnesota? We at the time, you know, where most of the nuggets are being used in Indiana, why didn't you do it there? Well, the iron ore is in Minnesota, so it made perfect sense to do it here, and our business models prove that the only way we could make it work was if we had a closely coupled iron ore operation with it and had an ownership stake in that operation as well. So we chose the former LTV site that went bankrupt. It was a site that was supported by the state, and a bunch of engineers looking at it, we think, right, this is a slam dunk. You know, place operated in 2001. We ought to be able to readily get a permit and come out there blazing as the nugget plant started up. Unfortunately, we had a permitting quagmire, and we about 4 years into the permitting effort and over $10 million, and I can tell you that we're no closer to getting a permit there than when we started permitting back in 2008. So the entire permitting issue that we ran into was all driven by historical legacy issues, had nothing to do with what we were proposing to do or what we're doing now. It was all related to the decades of mining that took place at that site before we even got there. At the point we hit the permitting problem, we were in a very, very high iron ore market, so we're in a struggling operation. At the same time, iron ore prices were very high. Operation was very, very difficult situation. We had to do something, so ultimately we formed our partnership with Magnetation. That's our mining resources facility just outside of Chisholm. We're the majority owner of that facility and the managing partner. I think the folks from Magnetation explained it very well. We think it's an environmental home run as well. We're processing long forgotten mineral resources that making them into the only value added product ultimately on the Iron Range. About an $80 million project there. We're very proud of the fact that we were able to, from the time we started the facility to the time we shovel in the ground to actually producing was right around 9 months. So for that level of activity, that type of industrial project to be up and going that length of time, very, very pleased with what we were able to accomplish there. Sorry about that. Didn't change the slide. Finally, just a few closing comments. I'd like to highlight once again, we're the only ones doing what we're doing, the first time facility, and I can tell you we've had a lot of growing pains. When you add up all the investment between the properties, we're right around $500 million invested in northeast of Minnesota at this point in time. And when Craig had the slide up, you know, we're the small guy in the block, so we don't think there's much going on at Mesabi Nugget, but $500 million is a lot of capital investment. We've created over 200 full-time jobs, not to mention the offshoot jobs that were mentioned earlier. Unfortunately, the difficulties we've had, last week we announced the $260 million write-down of the facility, and it's a direct evidence of the difficulties that we've had in getting the plant started up and the level of continued investment that we've had to make to get the technology to where we are right now. The last 6 months of operation have been the most stable, the most productive block of operating periods that we've had since we started the facility, so it gives us a lot of promise and hope that we're going to get to ultimately to where we need to be. Mr. Fedor mentioned earlier the raw materials market, and there's no question that they're under severe pressure. As I mentioned earlier, we produce a product that competes directly with imports and imports alone. All the pig iron that comes to the United States comes from Brazil or Eastern Europe, and that's where we're battling a strong dollar right now and ultimately a pig iron price that's receding. That's related directly to the scrap price, which is going down, which is tied to the iron ore price, which has dropped over 50% in the last 12 months. So we've talked about the increases in permitting costs and talked about the increases in power costs. Any of those things increases in our cost structure when we're struggling to survive with a brand new technology would be very, very difficult for us at this point in time. We've talked about, the folks before me talked about the environmental regulation. We do environmentally sound business operations in dozens of states around the United States. And we've absolutely come to the conclusion that the state of Minnesota is the most difficult state to do business in from an environmental regulation and ability to get permits and be able to move on. And the case in point is what I talked about in our Mesabi mining operation and the difficulties we had there, over $10 million, again, that we've spent with really nothing to show for it. We talked at length already, the folks at Cliffs, regarding the wild rice statutes and what they potentially could mean to the mining companies. And finally, when you tie all those things together, the ability to have a timeline that we can predict is what we need. You know, as a business operator, you have to be able to predict. As long as you know what the end point is, you can focus on it and you can go for it. But when that end point is moving all the time, you've got no way to plan for it, and it makes it very, very difficult to conduct business. Case in point, the DNR worked tremendously with us on our first mining resources permit. We're in the process of expanding the operation to the next group of basins, and some segments of that permit are well over. We're approaching a year now versus, you know, about 3 or 4 months the first time around. So again, everything is getting more and more difficult and more predictable for us. In closing, we've got a tremendous group, tremendous workforce in our sites, a very tenacious group. It's very hard to describe what it takes to beat your head against the wall as you're developing new technology, but I can tell you that we've had I can't say enough about the folks and what they've been able to accomplish. I appreciate the opportunity to talk to the group here today and your interest in Steel Dynamics and the Iron Range.
Thank you very much, Mr. Bednar. It's very informative. Members, I think you all are starting to sense some common threads in all of the presentations. Iron ore mining has issues with energy, issues with environmental regulations, and issues with the cost of compliance with environmental regulations, and not necessarily lastly, but a sense of frustration that the companies themselves are not equal participants in the process of developing environmental review and those regulations. I think that's pretty common, and they're being very polite, but I just thought I'd take a crack at summarizing some of that. Representative Metha.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I did want to point out it's not a specific question for you. You know, throughout the years, we are complimenting Magnetation on some of these resources, but I think we should, you know, thank those who came before us too. The university research done to develop taconite and the process up at Magnetation took a large state investment as well. So just recognizing those who did all the work to make that happen and made this hearing possible today for us to still be talking about taconite on the Iron Range.
Other questions? Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the very interesting presentation. I don't have a clue what a ton of a finished product or ore is worth in the market today. And I was wondering, you mentioned that it's down 50%, and I understand it's a commodity like anything else based on demand, but obviously I heard you say, you know, you produce 11 million tons production, and you've got a rather fixed cost, and that cost has to be burdened, you know, against those tons of production. But could you just give me an idea of what the historical trend has been as an average, you know, what a finished ton of raw product is for the mills?
The finished steel, Chairman, Representative, the finished ton of steel you're talking about, or the iron ore right now, the market, typical price they're talking about, everybody talks about an iron ore price delivered to China right now is $60-$65, where it was in the, say, around a year ago, we were $120, $130, perhaps $140 per ton.
And that excuse me, Mr. Chair, that's the raw product that goes to the blast furnace?
That's a ton of iron ore.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you very much, and we wish you success at Mesabi Nugget.
Thank you.
Next, we have U.S. Steel. U.S. Steel operates the largest of the plants on the Mesabi at Mintec, and also a large one at Keewatin Taconite, which is my home mine. We have Mr. Chris Machantonio, the General Manager for Public Policy and Governmental Affairs from U.S. Steel. And on the range, we commonly refer to U.S. Steel as the Oliver, because it was the Oliver Iron Mining Division of something else. And Peter Larson, of course, also representing U.S. Steel. Take it away, guys.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Let me first thank members of the committee and the legislature for establishing this committee. We think it's very important. Obviously, we believe mining to be very important to the economy in Minnesota, and by establishing this committee, you've recognized that, and we appreciate it. As you heard from all the other presenters, it's a challenging time for the mining industry, as it is for the American steel industry. There's a number of important decisions that are going to be made this year by the legislature that I think could have a profound impact on the future of mining here in Minnesota. So all of us look forward to working with you, and hopefully we make the right decisions, and we'll see another 100 years of mining in Minnesota. Our company is a steel company. United States Steel is an integrated steel producer. We're the largest integrated steel producer in North America. And as you heard from Steel Dynamics, it's a little bit of a different process. This is kind of making steel the old-fashioned way. When I say integrated, we have our own mines, coke plants, and steel plants. We take the iron ore pellets and the coke, and we put it into blast furnaces, and we add some limestone and a lot of energy. We make iron. And then we further process that iron, add a lot more energy and some other materials, and we make steel. And then we take that steel and cast it into different products. Our company primarily makes products for the construction industry, the automotive industry, the appliance industry, the container industry, and the oil and gas industry. We're the largest steel pipe producer also in North America, the energy industry. You'll see on the map where our facilities are located. These are our major operating facilities. We have a number of other joint ventures in other locations. The blast furnaces are located in Michigan, Illinois, Alabama, Indiana, and Pennsylvania. Obviously, the iron ore is coming from Minnesota, and you can see on the next slide where our facilities are located. Mintec is located in Mountain Iron, and Keetac in Keewatin, up on the Iron Range, of course. U.S. Steel is the largest producer of iron ore pellets in Minnesota. We produce approximately 22 million tons per year. We employ close to 1,900 people. We have an annual payroll in Minnesota of $141.8 million. And we provide health care benefits of $34.5 million to our Minnesota employees. We also have close to 1,600 retirees in Minnesota who worked at our Minnesota operations over the past years. We feel that our company plays an important economic role in Minnesota in a number of different ways. Foremost, we spend about $600 million a year on hiring Minnesota businesses, approximately 370 of those businesses that are suppliers and vendors to our mining operations up on the Iron Range. As Craig Pagel said earlier, for every mining job, 1.8 other jobs are created in Minnesota. We pay a production tax of approximately $43.8 million, at least that's what we paid in 2013. As most of you know, the beneficiaries of the production tax are the IRRB and some of the school districts up on the Iron Range. The IRRB designates projects in the community where those taxes are put to good use. The process that we follow at U.S. Steel at our two mining operations, and there's probably folks in the audience that could explain this a little better than me, but I'll take it through you quickly. The mining process starts by removing the waste, drilling, blasting, and mining the ore. We then take the ore to a large crusher facility where it goes through a number of stages. but the ore is reduced from anywhere from 5 to 8 feet in size down to anywhere from 8 inches to a half inch. From the crusher, we go to what we call the concentrator. It goes through another series of stages of grinding and separation. It is then taken down to the pelletizing operation, which is called the agglomerator, where we add limestone, bentonite, enter it into a large rotating kiln, and out comes the iron ore pellets, which are shipped by rail car to destinations, some of which rail car takes it all the way down to the blast furnaces, most of which, though, is transported over the Great Lakes to other blast furnace destinations. It's a very expensive, capital-intensive, energy-intensive process. Very challenging from a safety and environmental standpoint, which I'll touch on in a few minutes. Some more background facts about our operations. U.S. Steel began operating at Keetac and Minntac in 1967. We acquired the Keetac facilities from National Steel. Keetac has one pellet line operating. Minntac has five. Production at Keetac is about 6 million tons annually. Minntac is about 16 million tons annually. And I think Minntac is the largest operating mine in Minnesota. The size of the mines are impressive. If you haven't been there, we invite you all up to come visit at some point. Keetac is about 4.5 miles long, 1 mile wide, and 300 feet deep from the original elevation. Minntac, the larger of the two, is about 9 miles long, 1.5 miles wide, and 200 feet deep from the original elevation. Just to give you an example of the size of these facilities, we have what we refer to as our tailings basin at Minntac, which is really a processing area for discharge water. If you would see it, it looks like a large lake. It's about 8,000 acres. You can see we've outlined the size of the tailings basin over top of Minneapolis. And you can see how large it is. But that's just one part of the operation. Another revenue stream coming from the mining operations, at least for U.S. Steel, concerns our state royalty payments. We lease property from the state for the mining operations. And you can see on the slide that the royalties have increased pretty dramatically for the last several years. Today, both operations combined are contributing almost $55 million to the state. It goes to the school trust fund, which benefits public education in Minnesota. I think U.S. Steel's contribution to the school trust fund is about 90% of the total fund. So we're pretty proud that we're able to do that. Obviously, it's a part of doing business. It's a cost of doing business. But those funds are helping education in Minnesota. We think that's important, and it's a good thing that the mining industry does. There are challenges, and I think the chairman summarized the challenges. We share the same challenges that the rest of the presenters have already made, so I won't spend too much time or detail on explaining those. But permitting is a challenge. The director of the Metallic Mining Division of MPCA was here. She knows us very well. She probably spends more time working with U.S. Steel than most other companies. And you know what I'm going to explain here in the next couple minutes, I don't want to be taken the wrong way. We don't have a bad relationship with the MPCA. To the contrary, we spend a lot of time with the MPCA. We're probably one of their biggest customers. And it's just a matter of a degree of difficulty. You know, we're seeing things one way. They have some limitations they have to work under, and it's a challenge. It's a serious challenge. But I think, like you heard from the other presenters, we need to continue to work together, and we need to find solutions. There's really no other option. I mean, we got to find a way to make this work. It reminds me of, I was in a forum like this a couple years ago, and Senator David Tomasoni was speaking, and he said, you know, we've been mining for 100 years. You think we get it right by now? I think we know how to do this. And we tend to agree with the senator. We do know how to do this. And our company is very proud of what we do. We have a very proud workforce. The majority of our workers are represented by the USW. They take their jobs very seriously. They take protecting the environment very seriously. And thanks to them, I mean, we have one of the leading mining operations in the entire world up on the Iron Range. It's a great partnership we have with them, and I'll talk about them a little bit more in a minute here. There is a lot of uncertainty. You heard one of the presenters say we need predictability. That's the one thing business really needs. We need to be able to predict what our costs will be, what our timelines will be for installing new equipment, for achieving permits. Right now, we don't have any of that in Minnesota. It's very difficult. Interagency cooperation, this is a real challenge. And I don't need to sit up here and defend the MPCA, but I know there are times when they do want to help us, but the US EPA is telling them something that requires them to be less than helpful. So it's a real challenge. We need the US EPA and the MPCA to come to some common ground and help the mining industry in Minnesota. And we really feel MPCA is much better equipped to make those decisions than the US EPA. I mean, we'd rather have folks in Minnesota, from Minnesota, making those decisions than someone in Washington, D.C. Specifically, you heard about the sulfate standard, and I know a number of the committee members has worked closely with U.S. Steel on this topic. I won't get into a lot of detail, but there was a question earlier, and I think what we need to do is apply not just science, clearly we do, but some common sense. This proposed standard of 10 milligrams parts per liter is 10. Drinking water is 250. So the mines are being asked to really purify the water system below the naturally occurring 250 milligram per liter standard. That's oversimplifying it, but it's a fact. The study that was done to establish the 10 standard was conducted back in 1940. So why are we relying on that science when there has been subsequent science just this past year and a half by both the state, University of Minnesota, and their researchers, and independently industry research, both of which concluded 10 is not the standard. State's research and the industry research established 10 is not the standard. Something much further north than 10 is the standard. I don't know if we know what that standard is yet, but it's certainly not 10. So you have to ask the question, why are we applying 10 to permits today? The testimony from some of the other companies suggested we want to work with you on solving this problem. We need to. It's not just critical for the future of mining, but municipalities, agriculture, the farmers, everybody. This 10 standard is going to be a big problem for Minnesota if it isn't corrected. You heard a few comments from just about every presenter on power cost. I think United States Steel is the largest consumer of electricity in Minnesota at the mining operations. So you can imagine just a small shift in power cost for our company is a big hit to the bottom line. And right now, as you heard, it's a really challenging time for the mining industry. Keeping the cost of those pellets as competitive as possible in a global market is critical to our success. If we're adding cost to those pellets because we have to invest in environmental equipment that may be resulting in no environmental improvement, if we have to pay for higher electric bills, significantly higher, I'm not talking thousands of dollars, we're talking tens of millions of dollars, if we have to spend money on those costs, that goes right into the cost of the pellet, which makes us less competitive in the global market. A really bad time for any of that to be happening for the mining operations in Minnesota. So those will be the two big issues we're going to be working with you on the days and weeks to come. Both the sulfate standard and the energy cost. I just wanted to add a little bit more about U.S. Steel and our commitment to what we do in Minnesota. From an environmental standpoint, environmental responsibility is a core principle at United States Steel. Everything we do in Minnesota has a focus on protecting and preserving the environment. Our employees, certainly those represented by the United Steel workers who are here, share that same commitment. The steel workers are part of the Blue Green Alliance. They work closely with environmental organizations on a daily basis to protect and preserve the environment. We have that same commitment. Our commitment to you all is we're going to mine in a very responsible way, and we're going to protect and preserve that environment. We wouldn't do it any other way. Our employees, and certainly the steel workers, wouldn't allow us to do it any other way. So we make that commitment to you, and as part of that commitment, you can see on the chart, we spend about $10 million a year on average investing in various environmental projects, environmental corrective action, and environmental maintenance. Those are just the routine environmental costs for our company, $10 million a year. Like environmental responsibility, safety is a core principle. Our other commitment is we're going to operate the mines in a very safe and responsible manner. Again, I got to give the credit to the United Steelworkers. They represent the workers. We have a great relationship with them in Minnesota. We work cooperatively, and probably nothing is more important than safety. We want all of our employees to come to work safely and go home safely every day. And I'm proud to say that the safety record at MinTech and KeyTech is really leading our entire company right now. And you can see they've been recognized for that. The National Mining Association and the U.S. Department of Labor Mine Safety Health Administration has presented them with awards for the workplace safety accomplishments at MinTech and KeyTech. Speaking of the steel workers, I just want to mention to the committee, as some of you know this, but we do have a formal partnership that focuses on legislative activity and public policy. It's called the Iron Ore Alliance, and it's a partnership between U.S. Steel's operations and the United Steelworkers. And John Rebrovich is here. He's the sub-district director for the USW. John and I co-chair the initiative. We launched it in 2013. And we don't agree on everything all the time, but when we find items that we do agree on, we work together to find a solution. And I'm sure we'll be talking to all of you here in the days and weeks and months to come on a number of the topics we just talked about today. So I want to thank John and the steelworker leadership for the partnership. It's been very valuable, and we look forward to it continuing for many years to come. What's in store for the future? You know, in summary, our company wants to mine, employ, and invest. That's what we want to do in Minnesota. Run the mines, employ Minnesotans, and invest capital in the operations. That's all we want to do. We need your help to do that. We need to work our way through these environmental issues and these compliance issues and regulations. We need to, you know, maintain some competitive energy rate for the operations. There's a number of other challenges. We're working on all of them. We appreciate the relationship we have with all of you. Again, we appreciate you establishing the committee. I think it sends a good message to the mining industry that you know it's important. We know it's important, and now we can work together through this committee. So I went through it pretty quickly, but I think I touched on all the highlights, and Peter and I are happy to take any questions.
Thank
Mr.
you.
Chairman.
Members, we have about 18 minutes left, and I want to allow time for ESSER to make a presentation. Are there any questions? Representative Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to make a comment. I think it was 2013. I sit on the school trust fund lands, and we were able to tour some mines. And being a farm girl, I see a lot of large equipment, but I was absolutely amazed at how large the mining equipment is. It just was very impressive. And the area, I mean, not only the mine and how large it was and what you do there, but also the area around, how nice it looks, and, you know, the restoration parts. And I just was very impressed with it. You know, I hadn't seen it that up close before. So thank you very much. Thank you for the opportunity.
Rangers Lake Farms, too.
That's really good. That's a good thing.
Representative Mehta.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was wondering if you could go over, we briefly got a snapshot of what the Cliffs energy increases are, and we talked about 17 to 20%. Is that a similar percentage for you, or is...
Mr. Chair, Representative Mehta, yeah, that's ballpark. I think it could be anywhere between 20 and 30%. I mean, there's still some moving parts, and we're talking to a number of key stakeholders, including our provider, but it's significant. You know, being such a large consumer, I mean, making pellets, it's simply mining them and adding energy. I mean, that's what you're doing. So we're a huge energy consumer, and a 20, 30, 40% increase would be dramatic. Lots of money. So.
Other questions?
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Quickly, Representative Mehta.
I'll be quick. Thank you. So if these federal expectations of Minnesota with their coal standards and stuff were to be implemented in full, do you see Minnesota as a place to remain competitive as a business in comparison to our neighboring states?
I don't want to speak on behalf of the power industry. They can do that very well. But I did see a chart that was a public chart that listed all the power rates for the entire country. And Minnesota was near the top already. So I think the implementation of these federal requirements are going to put, you know, Minnesota in a place that's much less competitive than where they are now. So.
That's it. Thank you, Mr.
Thank you. One last question. Seeing none, thank you.
Thank you,
gentlemen.
Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Lastly, we'll hear from Esser Steel, a company that is in process of constructing a pellet plant at the old Butler Taconite site in Nashwauk. And with us is Mitch Brunfeld, fairly new on the job, Director of Government and Public Relations. Welcome, Mr. Brunfeld.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. As the chairman said, my name is Mitch Brunfeld. I'm the Assistant General Counsel and Director of Government and Public Relations for SR Steel Minnesota. I'm also a very proud fourth generation Iron Ranger, so I very much appreciate this opportunity today to talk about the iron mining industry in northeastern Minnesota and the critical importance of this industry, not only for our region, but also the importance of the mining industry for the state of Minnesota. The history of the Esser Steel Minnesota project really begins back in 1985. The Butler Taconite Mine, located northwest of the city of Nashwauk, permanently closed in 1985. When Butler Taconite closed its doors, hundreds of employees lost their jobs. The Butler mine site was reclaimed, and eventually all of the production facilities at the site were dismantled. The closure of Butler Taconite had a devastating impact on the regional economy. However, what remained was a good quality ore body, which could be developed for business with potential significant positive impact on the community and region. SR Steel Minnesota anticipates mining at the rate of approximately 21.5 million tons of crude ore annually, which equates to a mine life of approximately 80 years based on the quantity of resources in this ore body. That's a mine which will support three generations of miners on the Iron Range. So it's really for the future of mining, and it's obviously a very significant impact. We talk about the history of having accomplished 100 years of mining on the Iron Range. Well, with this project and some of the other projects you've heard about, there's another 100 years to come. And the support of the people on the Iron Range and to have these high-paying jobs is a tremendous economic engine for our area. The ore body at the old Butler site is a very good ore body. It's relatively low in silica content. This provides SR Steel Minnesota with the ability to produce not only a blast furnace pellet as feed for the traditional integrated steel plants, but also direct reduced pellets for electric arc steel making furnaces. Recognizing this business potential, a business enterprise known as Minnesota Iron and Steel, or MIS, began an effort back in the 1990s to reopen the former Butler mine site and to construct new facilities. While MIS did not succeed in its efforts, largely due to difficulties in obtaining requisite financing, the project was reactivated in 2004 by Minnesota Steel Industries, a company formed by one of the major stakeholders of MIS. Minnesota Steel Industries succeeded in obtaining necessary mineral leases for the ore body and obtained the necessary environmental permits. However, Minnesota Steel could not progress with project execution due to, again, lack of financing as well as an inability to execute such a large project. It is noteworthy here that the last taconite plant on the Iron Range was built in 1977, about 40 years ago, indicating significant challenges in building such large projects since that time. Therefore, the site of the former Butler mine remained purely a company on paper for many years, with no sponsors being able to prepare and implement a comprehensive execution plan. In October 2007, SR Steel Holdings acquired the fully permitted project from Minnesota Steel Industries and changed the name of the company to SR Steel Minnesota LLC. SR Steel Minnesota broke ground on the construction of this project in September 2008. Unfortunately, in the days and weeks following that September 2008 groundbreaking, we all know what happened. The worldwide economy went into a tailspin with the collapse of financial markets and the beginning of what's been termed the Great Recession. With the recession, there was a significant downturn in the steel markets, and obtaining project financing, especially for a project of this size, became a near impossibility. Nonetheless, from September 2008 to September 2012, SR Steel Minnesota was able to raise more than $1 billion in financing from its SR parent and a select group of Indian banks. SR Global is an Indian company. For the 4.1 million ton pellet plant, SR Steel also was able to make significant progress in the engineering, procurement activities, and construction of the taconite mine, crushing, concentrating, and pelletizing facilities, as well as construction of the rail, electric, water, and sewer infrastructure for the project. SR Steel Minnesota also obtained the necessary permits to increase the annual production capacity from 4.1 million tons to 7 million tons. SR Steel then undertook an intensive two-year effort to obtain the necessary financing to complete the taconite mine and pellet plant project. With the increase of the permitted annual pellet production capacity from 4.1 million tons to 7 million tons, the total capital expenditure for construction of just the taconite mine and pelletizing facilities will be over $1.8 billion. On September 30, 2014, SR Steel Minnesota succeeded in finalizing an $800 million financing package to complete construction and commence operations of the taconite mine and pellet plant. As of January of 2015, SR Steel Minnesota has already invested a total of approximately $1.3 billion for engineering, procurement, construction activities at the project site. So with financing in place, SR Steel has been able to resume intensive construction activities at the site as well as procurement activities. SR Steel Minnesota worked closely with its various construction contractors to return their work crews and equipment to the project site and to ramp up construction activities during the months of October and November 2014. By December 2014, construction activities at the project site were again well underway. During the months of January and February 2015, we've had over 200 construction workers at the project site. SR Steel Minnesota anticipates that once we get into the peak construction season in summer of 2015, we'll have 600 to 800 construction workers at the project site during the upcoming peak construction season. SR Steel Minnesota anticipates commissioning of its pellet production facilities by the end of 2015, and then we'll ramp up the full pellet production capacity during the course of 2016. Here's a few other highlights of this project. Again, this is a $1.8 billion capital investment in our state with $1.3 billion already invested to date. This is the largest economic development project on the Iron Range in over four decades. It's one of the largest greenfield projects in all of North America. SR Steel Minnesota's development of this project included acquisition of approximately 20,000 acres of land in the largest land exchange in the history of the state. Once the taconite mine and pellet plant are fully operational, we will employ up to 350 full-time employees with a projected annual payroll of more than $25 million. Once fully operational, the taconite mine and pelletizing operations also are projected to generate an additional 630 spin-off jobs in the region. The taconite mine and pelletizing operations also are projected to generate $170 to $180 million in new annual tax revenues for the state of Minnesota. This operation also will be a significant economic engine for the economy of northeastern Minnesota, with an infusion of $350 million per year of new spending, and that is excluding taconite taxes and other taxes. With regard to legislative activities during the 2015 legislative session, SR Steel, we will be focusing on seeking an extension of the project completion deadline related to certain grant monies previously provided by the state of Minnesota for the construction of the infrastructure at the SR Steel Minnesota project site. The public infrastructure for the project was funded by a $65.9 million economic development grant from the state of Minnesota. The infrastructure consisted primarily of electric utilities, rail, municipal water, and sewer. The power and rail facilities will generate about $3.4 million per year in revenues to the local units of government which own those assets. The grant for this project contained a standard deadline provision for the entire project to be completed by October 1st, 2015, In this case, the entire project was anticipated to be a mine, taconite pellet plant, a DRI plant, and a steel mill. SR Steel Minnesota will be seeking legislative approval for an extension of the October 2015 project completion deadline. Since the project was delayed for several years during the development and financing process in the backdrop of a global financial crisis, SR Steel Minnesota's focus right now is to complete construction of its taconite mine and pelletizing facilities and to commence those operations. Once the taconite operations are moving forward, the company will pursue appropriate value-added products at the site based upon its close monitoring of the market conditions. SR Steel Minnesota firmly believes that a North American infrastructure rebuild would certainly trigger demand for taconite, as well as further value-added products in a few years' time, and SR Steel Minnesota would readily seize upon any such opportunities. Mr. Chairman, that concludes my remarks. I would be happy to answer any
Thank
questions
you.
The committee may have.
Thank you very much. We have about 5 minutes for questions, and I know there are some. Fire away. Well, I guess I overshot the runway there. Yes, sir. Representative Constantine.
I don't have any questions for the gentleman. I have a general question, though, when we get to that point.
Okay. Any questions? Thank you very much for coming,
Mr. Chair. Mr. Brunkett, thank you for
thank you very much.
Time.
And we wish you well.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Constantine.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Yeah, I'm tired of hearing Representative Dill talk about that list, though I think it's a very fine idea. So could somebody explain to me what the obstacles are in getting that list?
You've all heard the question. Does anybody care to tackle that? Representative Dill.
Well, I hope Representative Constantine isn't on the list, but that being said, I think that's a PCA question. We ask them a direct question, is there a list? And they said no. And I ask them, how can you introduce it, put it in permits? And because they can. And we need to straighten that out. Because, you don't realize that this standard was ignored since 1940. No one even heard about it until a few years ago in a committee here in the Minnesota legislature, and suddenly it became the preeminent issue for the future of the mines. And like I said, we need to do something about it.
Thank you for that, Representative Dill. Of course, the list that Representative Considine is asking about is the list of designated wild rice waters that doesn't seem to exist. Follow-up?
Yeah, aren't we the legislature? Can't we ask them to do that?
We sure can. Representative Metza.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Representative, we'll have a bill for you to sign on to shortly that's in the works that clarifies some of that. And a difference of opinion, I would agree, is not a good enough reason to implement a rule, especially when one industry is isolated out. We have farm country to deal with over in the good northwestern part of the state. A lot of wild rice waters over there, and I think this is something Minnesotans, should have a clear answer on that is respectful of, Clean Water Act, but also at the same time treating industry fairly. And right now, we're the only industry being isolated out.
Thank you for that, Representative, and Mr. Chairman, the real chairman, Representative Hackbarth. Do you have any messages or comments about the committee going forward before we adjourn?
I just wanted to say thank you, Mr. Chairman. Next week we'll probably hear our first bill or two on Tuesday, and then we have the deer population issue on Wednesday.
Okay.
Looking forward to that.
Members, thank you very much for your attentiveness.